the first thing that people do is they have a political position. And today on the internet, that basically means fuck America. That's like the 95% of what I see on Twitter is the political position. And then from there, all the foreign policy positions will come. So for Israel-Palestine, it's a very easy analysis. The U.S. supports Israel, so fuck Israel and support Palestinians. The historical analyses are often crude at best or misleading or counterfactual. Yeah. Oh, go ahead. Or did you want to?
Just to be clear, you think they begin with fuck America and then come to the conclusion rather than seeing like the mountain of corpses and come to the conclusion fuck America?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct, because the mountains of corpses that we look at are very selective.
Yeah. All right. I am Ben Burgess. This is Give Them an Argument. I am joined, as always, by our super producer, Jake Appett, and our very talented graphic designer, J. Andrew World. We are also joined today by my good friend, Left Reckoning co-host, journalist, son of Texas, David Griscom. How are you doing, David?
Hey, man, I'm doing pretty good. Happy to be
here. So we are going to be joined in a few minutes by Nathan Robinson to talk about that debate that we just saw a snippet of with Stephen Bunnell, better known as Destiny. So I you heard Nathan refer to that a few times. This is a date with Destiny, but that bit about how people just have this bias towards fuck America, and so that's why they come to the conclusions that they come to, rather than maybe organically having a human reaction to like mass atrocities that are being committed with American aid, really struck me as like kind of a pretty good 30-second summary of what goes on in the rest of those 2 hours.
I gotta give it to the argument here that people are just sort of reacting from like a general anti-Americanism, whatever to that. But it is, I guess, a little bit of an astute observation to sort of see Israel's foreign policy and associate and recognize the connection that it has to American domestic and foreign policy. So what I mean by that is, like, it's not really the opinion of like an idiot or somebody who's not paying attention that there's a connection between Israel.
Yeah, and right.
You know what I mean? But anyway.
Yeah, right. Because like, if you're not really paying attention, it's just like, oh yeah, there's some people in the Middle East who are killing other people in the Middle East, right? Like, it wouldn't be like, you actually do kind of have to like follow things somewhat to like realize,
at least a little bit. You know what I mean?
Yeah, quite how big a role the United States plays in all of this. We'll be moving to our date with Destiny later in the hour, but I want to start in there's some more serious stuff I want to talk about in a few minutes, but I want to start in David Griscom's part of the world, which specifically is Austin, Texas. And I think about, broadcasters, podcasters who live in Austin, Texas. And, you think there's you've got your David Griscom, you've got your Joe Rogan, Lex Friedman, I think, is there. And
R.M.
Brown, of course. Yes. R.M. Brown is there. Good friend of the show. And also you have this gentleman.
Put pressure on Trump to educate Trump and educate his family and his friends, everybody else, to educate him, to get him to come out against us, because he said, I don't want to hear from Alex anymore, and I don't want to hear from you about him. Okay? Well, guess what, buddy? You don't want to hear from us, you're going to hear from us, because I'm going to do my duty to make sure you know all about this stuff, and then I usually have a lot of the answers. I don't claim I have all of them, but I'm a pretty decisive guy. On this, I don't know what I'm going to do. If they release some new damn virus and he is out there promoting it, maybe I'll just move to some island in the middle of nowhere and just, I mean, it's just, and look, we can't put all our faith in one man. We all get sucked into this Trump thing and it becomes everything. That's kind of blackpilled though. No, it's an important fight. We need to get him in there. That's my gut tells us the right thing to do. But God also tells me, the Holy Spirit also tells me, don't be a Trump follower, be a Trump backer, so we have a guy in there that we can put pressure on. And that's one of the biggest problems of conservatives and populists, is we put him in there and we're like, oh my God, he's the Messiah, and Q says he's invincible, that was all CIA. Leave him alone, don't put any pressure on him. Let him just save us all, trust the plan. And that is not what we need to do.
The awesome thing about that, we were talking about this earlier, Jake pointed out, a lot of this just feels like a mirror image of like leftists talking about Bernie and, you know, like what limitations Bernie Sanders has politically, and it's good to support him, but you got to put pressure on him to be better at this and that. But then he just throws it out of nowhere that QAnon is a CIA conspiracy.
Well, he hated Q. You know, I mean, Q is coming for his thing. Q wasn't, you know, Alex Jones. I mean, for real, it was like a real danger to him. So he was very quick, actually. Like, Q is all fake, which is awesome. I mean, I have been, you know, watching a little bit more Alex Jones. And what I mean, you know, watching a little bit more Alex Jones, going to his website and clicking at random parts in his streams, because there's always something amazing in them. One thing I've grown to appreciate a lot about him is, you know, why he's a better broadcaster than I think all of us. I'm sorry, yes. Friends. Is the professionalism. You see, his camera captures his desk, and that desk is pristine with all of the news of the day. He has all of the articles printed out perfectly, and he just will hold them up every once in a while. And he did a whole thing on when Joe Biden was pushing the GOP immigration plan. You know, which is basically all the shit that they wanted. And then, you know, Biden starts pushing and they don't want it. They didn't like the way that Biden was going to harass and torture people at the border. Alex Jones has a whole thing printed out. He's like, I've read this whole thing and there's about 30 things in here that shocked me. And then he never goes on to say what they are, but he just like holds up the big stack of papers.
Yeah, Alex Jones like, definitely read the whole thing. Yeah, no, that's awesome. I mean, it is really like, I've got to say, like, just in passing, like, it is fucking amazing, right? That, like, I start to our friend Bronco Marchteach pointing this out. It's like all the stuff that, like, not only that, like, so many progressive people spent years calling fascism, you know, during the Trump administration, but like the most actually fascist part of those people's program. That like now the move is like, oh, why won't the Republicans responsibly work together with us to enact the fascism? It's like, wait, what? Right? Like, I thought this was like the most monstrous thing about Trump and like why it was so important to get rid of Trump. And, you know, now it's like, look, we had a nice bipartisan bill to eliminate due process for asylum seekers, but because Republicans can't govern, you know, we couldn't get it through.
No, I mean, it really is monstrous, and it's honestly not too surprising if you've been following like the history of the Democratic Party and its concert with the Democrats, that like, yeah, we would basically get to the point where the Democratic line is not so much like, hey, let's not do terror at the border. Hey, let's not harass desperate and desperate Pete folks. It's that the Republicans don't really know how to do it well. And they're not really organized and able to manage this thing. So we basically, yeah, like, you know, hand it over to us. We'll terrorize the migrants way better than the Republicans ever could. And, you know, I can't imagine that we're not. I mean, look, it was one of those things. I mean, I know I've come on your program and I've talked about to a few, you know, other folks, you know, Greg Abbott's busing program, mm-hmm. which was, you know, really nasty. You know, and I posed it then as I pose it now. But it's very true. That man, it did not take very much to get liberals in New York and in Chicago and a lot of other parts of the country to be like, there's an invasion going on and we need to shut down the border. Right. And it was shocking to see how, you know, just a couple years out from Donald Trump, is Hitler because of what he's doing at the border too. Oh, yeah. Actually, like there is a big problem.
Yeah, no, definitely. And, you know, and it's a very, you know, it's like, you know, and it's not even wrong to say that this, you know, that the you know, system for processing asylum seekers is broken, and, you know, and that there is that the way things are currently, you know, done is unworkable. But just the, you know, idea that the solution to this is doing like the sort of Trumpian wish list of things to, you know, deprive people of real hearings, and, you know, sometimes deprive them of any hearing at all, and send them back to often like desperate and terrified circumstances, really says everything, I think, about the mainstream politics of the moment. Right. It's also just, by the way, it is really worth taking a beat to think about how asinine it is, even as like a cold-blooded political tactic, that like, who's the voter where this is their top issue? And they're going to be like, all right, I guess I'll vote for Biden. You know, it's like the Republicans were irresponsible about this. Mm-hmm. Like, voter exist?
You know, it's honestly like, I don't know. Yeah, it is amazing to watch them try this time and time again and think that it's, you know, this is going to be the time that it works. I mean, we're watching Con Allred, who's going to be the Democrat running against Ted Cruz here in Texas. You know, and he's doing a kind of similar thing. Like, he signed on with that Republican letter saying that he disagrees with Joe Biden's open border policies, you know, and all this kind of stuff. It's like, what wild. I would love to meet them, frankly. Is like some guy who's really worked up about the border watching Fox News all the time. It's like, you know what? I'm a little done with Ted Cruz. I'm going to go for this Con Allred guy because I think he's going to do it. All right. It's like, no. You're never going to out cruelty the Republicans when it comes to immigration. And all that, but you know, and it's not just like, and let's just be really clear here. Like, the problem is not so much that like, oh, this is a failed political strategy for the Democrats. It is. We all know that. Who gives a shit?
Sure.
The biggest problem is that like, what it actually means is that whoever wins, we get the same policy at the border.
Yeah, no, exactly. That, you know, like the, you know, I mean, I think that it's, I think nobody can really know exactly what Trump would do there, because I guess, to be fair, when he was president before, he broke tons of his promises, both bad ones and good ones. But the signaling has been terrifying. You know, last week we watched the clip from, you know, if there was that speech in Ohio that like, there was all this discourse about it because he used the word bloodbath, and, you know, it was like that was being, you know, that was being played up in headlines. Then all the right wingers are like, no, but in context, it's not really saying that, et cetera. It's like, what all that completely missed was that there was also a thing in there where he did this like lurid fantasy that like is at the level of something, frankly, that Alex Jones would say about how there are, you know, Latin American countries, they're emptying their prisons of like MS-13 guys and driving them to the border so they could, you know, apply for asylum. And he said that, you know, some of these people, you know, some of them, you know, people, I mean, if you're going to call them people, I don't think they are people. You know, you're not supposed to say that. The radical left gets very mad. And it's like, well, okay, that's like lightly Hitlerian, you know, that like the, that you're going to say that members of a disfavored group, you know, aren't people. But yeah, as you say, I mean, we are going to get the same, you know, essential drift. The drift of border policy, you know, is unfortunately bipartisan. And this is, I think, one of many things about the way that the mainstream political moment is right now, that I think maybe because there seem to be so few openings for some kind of like robust left alternative, helps to lead to what actually the main reason that, you know, that I asked if you could, you know, join us today, which is something I saw you say on a Griscom stream a few days ago. I think we have that clip.
The thing that has been a little tough, for me to watch, is that you're seeing already the progressive Bernie socialist movement, however you want to define these milieus, is retreated inward on itself. You know, for a while I was sort of arguing and hoping that people wouldn't do it and say, hey, let's not, you know, retreat it in a, on ourselves. Let's not do it. That's happened. That's where we're at right now. It's a shame. Wish it didn't. So the hope and the fight now has to be to reverse that withdrawal internally, and remember what it means to do mass politics, right? Politics for your neighbor, for our friends and comrades and brothers and sisters, you know, all around the world, and Palestine and Bolivia and Brazil and China. And, you know, remember what it is to do mass politics, which means fighting these big fights against empire, fighting these big fights against capitalism. And what that means is building sustained political movements that are mobilizing significant amounts of people and giving people a future that is worth fighting for, something that's worth sacrificing for. That's not what's going on at all right now. It's, you know, internal political squabbles. It's defense of kind of like elite progressive class, hoping that those gains are defended. It's waging war against one another. Oh, you like this person, you like that person. you know, and it would be something if it was happening in some kind of ideologically clarifying way, where it's like, hey, we need to get rid of the folks who don't have a fundamental critique of capitalism at the center of their politics, who don't believe in building working class power. They might like working class people, but they don't think that everyday people should be the folks in charge, right? It would be one thing if these fights were more ideologically clarifying. But now it's just personal, ridiculous, narcissistic squabbles that we're seeing. Things that if you were to explain the stakes to an everyday person would be incomprehensible to them. Not only because ideologically they're just not lined up, but it's so granular. And the things that people are getting attacked for saying are very normal opinions to have. You know, try not to be too pessimistic, but that's the world that we're in right now. And, you know, the leftism, whatever you want to call that, versus working class politics or versus socialism, you know, it's sad to see the less edifying, the less clear political ideology, one that is very amorphous and is always existing only in the moment, because it changes consistently. What it means to be a leftist, what it means to be a leftist was the different thing in 2017, which is the main, what was the main focus of being on a leftist in 2017 versus being a leftist in 2024. They're always changing. In fact, oftentimes contradictory. Now, being a socialist, that's something that has a root and a heart. It's an idea that everyday people can govern, that everyday people are being screwed over by the system, and that they should be enjoying the fruits of the work that they do. They should be living longer and better lives, not worse and shorter ones, right? It is the radical belief at its fundamental, at its most fundamental, in democratic politics, in the idea that from the people, we can build a better world and a better future, right? That's what socialism is. And at its heart is a critique of capitalism. And a promise, though, and a fundamental, radical, revolutionary, and optimistic promise that out of a system that harms so many folks, we can take the productive capacities, the productive capacities, the ability to create abundance, and utilize those for the masses, for the people, for us. Leftism, you know, a lot of good leftists out there, but it's just not something that has an internal coherence and a commitment. Oftentimes, when you think about the left, what does that mean more than anything? It's a oppositional force, right? Oh, the left is opposed to the right. Well, that creates a kind of very bipolar politics, and we're watching it play out right now. And the sad thing is that while it seemed like a lot of doors were opening up, we're seeing our own movement shutting those. And I mean, a lot of that has already happened. And my hope and what I advocate for and continue to advocate for until I can't anymore, until I'm not here anymore, is that we reopen those doors, we recommit
to doing mass politics, doing politics for the people, recommit to the working class, and orient ourselves not just around them, but as a part of that movement. And move as far away from a kind of alienating, performative, individualistic. And that's the other thing about leftism versus socialism is leftism is a very individualistic, very neoliberal way of doing politics.
Yeah. And, you know, the reason I played that is that earlier, you know, past David, looking very sharp, as somebody said in the chat, you know, was saying a lot of things there that really resonated with my my experience of this, right? That there's like a sort of way that people orient themselves towards like whatever the discourse is about that week, right? Which changes every week, you know, because that's the nature of the discourse. That, you know, people have this like way of orienting themselves towards that. It's about teams and vibes, that has to do with like what you need to say on this or that topic to signal that, you know, you're on the right team, which it's not even like, man, you know, say what you want about Leninism. At least there's like the debate before the party Congress, right? You know, then you like, then you all decide what your position is, you know, rather, whereas here it's often very unclear to me what the process is, you know, for deciding on the position. But that like none of this really has to do with why, you know, why I'm a socialist, right? Why I care about this stuff, right? You know, the reasons why I care about this stuff are what you're articulating in the clip that, you know, I care, you know, I think it's fundamentally obscene that, you know, we have a society that, you know, distributes resources and power in this way. And, you know, I want a different kind of society. And, you know, there are sort of second order questions that, you know, you can extract principles from that and, you know, decide what you think about, but, you know, but it is, you know, there is oftentimes a very big and troubling disconnect between, you know, between having these politics that are based on those principles and this much more ephemeral sense of, you know, the left is a team that I think you're articulating in that clip.
Yeah. I mean, you know, so like I'm all good. I'm super happy, you know, just came back from honeymoon, just got married.
Yeah.
No, but like, you know
that, Mazel tov, by the way.
No, thank you. No, what I'm saying is like, you know, also one thing I think that people need to get a lot better at is being able to hold two things in their head at once, which is like one, like your life and like politics, right? And I think there's some oftentimes a conflation that can be really unhealthy that a lot of folks, you know, and our communities can fall into on that. But that's a whole other thing. That's just the wisdom that comes with this big milestone. No, but like, I mean, it's something that's always bugged me. And it's like, look, I'm not somebody who's trying to get super worked up about like definitions or like, do you have like fidelity to this or that theorist? But there's something that I think has become really clear to me that like leftism, which is what most people use as the moniker for their politics, that doesn't really, I think, describe too much about what it is that you believe, because as I was saying earlier, it's like that's something that is regularly shifting and changing. Look, it gives me, if you say you're a leftist, I just sort of know what you're not for sure.
Yeah.
And you know, at the same time, it's like socialists, you know, we all know a boomer who says, oh, I was a socialist when I was younger, that just meant that they voted for Kennedy or something like that.
Right? Yeah.
But you know, socialism, at least like if you boil it down, we can start to get to some ideas. One, we know that it is an anti-capitalist philosophy. It is a way of looking at the world that is pro-worker, while leftism, again, one, because leftism is oftentimes a negative politics, and what I mean by that is it is opposed to the right. That means that it's unmoored, right, in the sense of it's not being steered even by its own members. Oftentimes it is reactive to whatever the right wing is doing. But what I think was bothering me most has been that, like, you know, I would get mad at folks who would complain about DSA kind of like, I don't know, let's call them culture politics or things like that. You know, back in 2017, 2018, 2019, look, and a lot of those folks are making accurate critiques. But in my mind, it was one of those things. It's like, you know, you can argue about these things, but actually getting out in the world and doing politics sort of rectifies those things, right? Sort of kind of practices that aren't really going to, like, one, aren't effective at the stated goal, and two, aren't really attractive to other folks. Like, those sort of get ground down over, like, the actual work of doing mass politics. But we're in a point right now where I think the mass politics has almost completely evaporated from the left, apart from Palestinian justice organizing. And I, you know, I think that's incredibly important, but I don't know how well that is going to translate into activity and action into our other kind of politics. And I'm not saying that, you know, this in some way of like, oh, we need to not do this or to the exclusion of that, but to sort of recognize that, like, the experience of, like, wow, a lot of people really mobilized right now is going to feel very similar to the way that politics felt, for example, during the height of the Black Lives Matter protests, when people were like, wow, there's a lot of people engaged right now. Well, you know, yeah, for a while. And then a few months, you know, less people started showing up to the rallies. The rallies then stopped, right? And sort of figuring out where what's next for our politics. We are still in that crisis. And you look at, like, the electoral realm, I'm not even getting into strategies of who's...
Sure.
Look at the major political projects of, like, socialist groups across the country. Oftentimes, again, they are reactive and negative. And again, I'm not saying that that means that they're wrong. I'm using that as a descriptive to say, hey, a lot of times what we're organizing around is saying to the state, to the government, to the bosses, no, don't do this to us. No, don't take this away from us, you know, instead of us actually achieving and gaining ground on these kind of things. And again, I'm not saying, with all this stuff, it's not me saying we should not be doing that kind of thing. What I'm saying is, like, you need to start to recognize that we are in a moment where our movements are almost entirely in an oppositional form. And that does not give you the sustenance to maintain a movement, in my opinion, to do you know, the politics that we need to do, which is going to be long term. And two, you know, that's something that is, like, not going to have the same ability to, I think, bring in as many people as a kind of politics that says, yes, we want to stop all this bad stuff that the right's doing, but also we want to do all this other stuff for the future. And that side of our politics, I think the optimistic side of our politics, is you're watching it evaporate. And look, I understand where it comes from. There's not, strategically, we're in a difficult moment. But yeah, I mean, that's a big frustration of mine right now.
Yeah. Hard yes to all of that. And I think that, you know, I mean, it's interesting, you know, I know we're going to bring on Nathan in just a minute. You know, I have, you know, it is very inspiring to see how much energy there is around Palestine. And I've got to say, personally, as somebody who, you know, I've thought about this many times the last few months, this is probably the subject I can remember argue with people about for the longest in my life, you know. And so it's been incredibly important to me for a very long time, you know, and I find it really heartening, you know, to that like there's so much more dissent on that, you know, than there ever was, you know, certainly in my lifetime. And I think really ever in the United States. But as you say, there's also a question about what's sustaining, right? You know, that in other words, that if, you know, that, you know, movements cropping up to oppose whatever horrible thing is going on right now, you know, that's necessary, but it's not really something that has, you know, momentum over years and decades, and you know, can by itself actually, you know, exert power in American society in a way that could make future reactions less likely to be necessary. And that's not to say don't do it, of course do it, right? But like but you know, I think it is really important to have a sense of what your you know, of what your vision is, what your strategy is, and you know, which is why, you know, I mean, I continue to think, like, if we just had to pick, right, one thing, right, the thing that's sort of the most important, you know, to do in terms of changing the power calculations for everything, you know, going forward is you know, workplace organizing, because that's the because that, you know, there's never been a successful socialist movement that didn't have that at its base. And, you know, so yeah, I would say,
Please. No, I'm just, and I know we're short on time, so I won't go into the whole thing, but, you know, just like on that workplace thing, it's like, absolutely. And I totally agree. You know, big Sean Fain backer, big backer of all this kind of stuff, but just two quick things on it, because that's correct. But I would just add to it that, you know, the kind of, I think the stage politics, right, where it's like, okay, once we get to union density to this level, we can do this and that. I think that that's not necessarily true or even historically accurate. I think it's important to re-engage union work in this country. But what's more important than anything is like actually that focus and that development of our politics amongst like the working class. And what I see happening right now with like, let's call it leftism, is this return to Ben, you know, you've lived through a few versions of this. But this return to what if we did politics without a subject, or maybe more accurately, like what if we found a way to do left politics without the working class? And we're watching that kind of stuff happen. And I don't want to bore people, and we don't have time to get into the other, you know, new ideas on the left. But I mean, a bunch of them, we're getting right back into the same ideas. What if we did left politics without the working class? Right? You see that with the degrowth folks, you see that with a few of the other groups out there. And look, that's another example of, you know, I think some of these issues and fear of doing mass politics again.
Yeah. Now get those NGOs and academics and, you know, I always think of the HBO show Rome, where there's the right after Caesar's assassinated, Mark Antony is going to negotiate with the conspirators, and they're like, oh, all the men of quality are with us. We've got the Lictors Guild. We've got this. It's like, man, just get the bakers and the flute players and you can hold a festival, right? Like, if you actually want to fundamentally alter the distribution of power and resources in the society that we live in and fundamentally transform it, you know, you do need a vision that has, you know, an organized and mobilized working class. It's hard. And I certainly don't mean to suggest that like you just do workplace stuff for 10 years and then you'll be ready to do the next thing or whatever. I agree that that's not quite how it works, but I do think that if you don't have that fundamental vision, you end up spinning your wheels in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. I've definitely used the L word lots of times as a convenient shorthand, but
show's called Left Reckoning. You know what I mean?
You know, but it's but I definitely take your point about being more specific. So really, friendly amendment. Really, Alex Jones should be saying, "I will eat your socialist ass." So you know, we'll just all be clear on that. Also glad
before I go just really fast on Jones, I just have to say, you know, because I follow him on social media and you know, he's gone through his divorce and he used to live in a fancy neighborhood west of here. I think he's getting pretty close to me because people keep on sending me photos or something will happen on like Austin social media and it'll be like, oh shit, I know exactly what, like that's 5-10 minutes from my house. Alex Jones, as he gets canceled over and over, is like very close to me being one of his neighbors who he's talking about eating on his stream. Like,
well, look, I look forward to that sitcom. The Alex Jones, David Griskin buddy comedy.
I did put up the follow-up tweet he did where he tries to explain it.
Okay.
You ever been hungry?
That's also, I'm also glad that you mentioned that you just got married, because I didn't, you know, I hadn't previously wanted to mention it on air just in case we're, you know, separation of the public and private spheres, but it was a beautiful wedding and so very happy for you, brother. I will talk to you very soon.
Sounds good, man. Thank you for being here. Great to see both of y'all as well. Good friends, and take care, everyone.
Yeah, congratulations.
Thank you.
All right. We are now joined by current affairs editor, author of many books about many things, and recent debater of Stephen Bunnell, better known as Destiny, Nathan J. Robinson. How are you doing?
Hey, Ben. Nice to be with you. Andy,
Jay. Yeah, I don't know who the New Orleans
equivalent is. I'm sad I missed David. I like David so much.
Yeah. I don't know who the New Orleans
is. To say how much I like David, but send him my best.
All right. Well, next time we'll make sure you got a couple minutes of overlap so you can express that. But Yeah, I was going to say, I don't know who the New Orleans equivalent would be of Alex Jones that you know, you could have your, you know, buddy comedy sitcom like they're with, like we're floating, you know, that. But, you know, there has to be, I don't know. New Orleans seems like a city that
we're
could, a city, like,
yeah, we're loaded with lunatics.
Yeah, exactly.
Is public access still a thing? Hopefully the next New Orleans Alex Jones is somewhere on public access in New Orleans. I saw some people lamenting how the public, you know, public access has a certain energy that just can't be created by Twitch or YouTube. And Alex Jones, I think, is a good evidence of that.
You know, I used to be on public access in high school. I had a public access television show called Electric Discourse that was watched by about 5 people.
Okay.
All right.
Those archives might still be out there somewhere.
we should find out if they are. Do you, I assume that everybody here has seen the old Bernie Sanders public access.
Yes.
Show. Oh, yeah.
All the best started out on public access, apparently.
Which is just like amazing because it's from the 1980s and he's like indistinguishable.
he's got the Mulgoths from Vermont too, which is great.
Yeah.
But it's like you put like obviously the setting he's in is very different. You could tell that it's a long time ago, but he just looks like he time traveled there.
Yes. And his DeLorean with his assistant.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, I do see we have the follow-up tweet. Alex Jones says the left has misunderstood what my intention was in posting this meme. I was talking about the Road Warrior collapse that has already begun because of the policies of the Great Reset. I'm talking about cannibalism as defined by the consumption of another human's flesh. 10 days without food and over 80% of people start eating each other. I wonder where it gets that. Anyway, you guys want to bring down civilization, so I just wanted to warn you. Good luck.
Has it been unexpectedly good on Palestine? Didn't he say something recently?
Yeah. I was on a crystal ball this morning.
Yeah, no, he actually did, interestingly enough, he actually did say that he thought it was a genocide.
I felt recently...
When you've lost Alex Jones, I don't know what you have left.
Although I actually think Alex Jones, I was thinking about it, I feel like we should have won him for the left back in the 90s when he was just like an Austin public access weirdo conspiracy guy. Like, that's the sort of person who really, like, given his starting point, should end up a leftist. And the fact that he ended up where he did is kind of our failure.
Well, on the comments to the video that we pulled of Alex Jones, I saw some people, you know, they're talking about kind of like how the left or socialists could talk about Bernie saying, you know, he's not the end all be all. So some people were critiquing Trump and Alex Jones' comments, and someone was like, you know, plus Trump's a Zionist, you know, and he's a Zionist. He's pro-vaccine. There's a lot not to like about the guy. just a great, great just melange of political stuff going on over there. So
yeah, well,
organize on Palestine. Yeah, good transition, right?
Yeah, well, you know, something else that I would think would, you know, bring in pretty much everybody, right? You know, I mean, even what Israel's already been doing in Gaza has even alienated such right stalwarts as Alex Jones. But I would like to think that even like you're like Eli Lakes and Rabbi Shmulies might experience like a momentary hesitation about making excuses for Israel. If, for example, they nuked Gaza, right? That this would be like, okay, look, you know, if whatever else you do or don't want to call genocide, you know, surely this would count. But we have a clip for this.
I heard you say on your debate, like Israel could drop a nuclear bomb and kill 2 million Gazans, and it might not be legally genocide.
If Israel were to literally nuke the Gaza Strip and kill 2 million people, I don't know if that would qualify for the crime of
genocide.
In
your eyes, probably not.
Because parts of genocide are the act, which nuking the Gaza Strip would certainly qualify for.
The nuclear
but
bomb,
the other part would be the intent to eliminate a group of people. Yeah. Right.
Well, I mean, I think that there have been enough statements by high Israeli officials about their desire to flatten Gaza that if they hadn't flattened Gaza, we could pretty well assume they intended to flatten Gaza.
True. That is true. But if we're trying to tease out the difference, then is the difference between genocide and war?
Well, the difference would be that if I want to flatten a city,
that's, you know, and all the people in it.
I mean, like, there were the, we dropped two atomic bombs on Japan. There was the firebombing of Tokyo. I think we razed about 26 different cities to the ground. There was the bombing in Dresden.
Wait a second, am I going to be the one who did, hang on a minute.
Sure.
You're talking to a leftist. I find the atomic bombs just one of the most hideous genocidal crimes in history.
Sure. And that's fine if you, well, wait, you said genocidal. You know, like, I agree that they were, we can argue that they were bad, or they can argue that civilians died, but genocidal?
You know, remember what they said? They said there are no civilians in Japan.
Yes, but is that genocidal?
And that's why it was justified to intentionally try and obliterate a huge number of civilians.
So then what is genocide in your mind then? What does that mean to you then?
I mean, the term is imprecise in terms of how it applies to different situations.
Well, I think it's pretty precise.
When you try to eliminate through violence a lot of people, and a huge part of why you're doing that, or why you don't value their lives, is because they are different from you. I think those situations get closer and closer to what we would classify as
genocide. I 1,000,000,000% agree with you. I think you've actually, I think what you stated is enough to be genocide. Yeah. I would say that, because they're different to you or whatever.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the argument here would be that if Israel accidentally nukes Gaza, that wouldn't be genocide.
Well, I think the argument is if they nuked Gaza in order to accomplish, I don't feel like being charitable to him, but to be charitable to him, I think that he really does believe that if you do anything, but you do it in the pursuit of another objective, it can't be genocide, right? So you could deliberately murder 2 million people, but if you weren't trying to eliminate the 2 million people for its own sake, but we're trying to do it self-defense or whatever, it would not be genocidal. I think that is the claim he would make.
It seems like a lot of people kind of have what they consider like maybe like the Nazis' genocide of Jewish people as their like standard of like, if it doesn't meet that, it's not genocide. I mean, at the end of the day, genocide is a word, right? So it just depends on how you define it. But I mean, I think that, like, you know, when I was looking into how scholars of that term and in that field define it, it you don't have to be at that level, right? Of like just literally eliminating every single member with like a gas chamber and have no other political goal. Not to say the Nazis had no other political goal, but we could count something like that as like one of the farthest extremes we've ever seen of
just scholars. Sorry, but I mean, like, if you look at the definition in international law, right, for the UN on genocide, right, it doesn't require that you be trying to kill every single member of a group. But there is a list of kinds of acts that you can commit that, when paired with the intention, does count as genocidal. And so in particular, I understand that in kind of ordinary language, often, you know, sort of casual news readers, we make a distinction, you know, between ethnic cleansing and genocide, that, you know, that ethnic cleansing is when, you know, that like is sort of the lighter version of genocide, right? Is roughly how
half the calories, but all the genocide.
Exactly. Genocide with half the calories. But under international law, I mean, if you're killing huge numbers of members of a group with the intention of inducing the rest of the group to relocate somewhere else, that's absolutely genocide, right? In the legal sense.
But also, Nathan, what's his fucking point? Because there's obviously intent. So what's the point of arguing all of it?
That's the other thing, right? Is that I pointed out that we have dozens and dozens and dozens of statements from very high-ranking Israelis saying things like, you know, we're going to do the second half of the Nakba now. We're going to seize this opportunity to get rid of all these people for once. Gaza's never going to be, you know, a functional place anymore. I posted a bunch of these on Twitter just yesterday, you know, these quotes after quotes after quotes.
And they're pretty explicit about it. So what are we even arguing about?
No, yeah. I mean, I've certainly seen Israeli politicians actually use the word Nakba, you know, Nakba 2024, Nakba in Gaza. I've seen plenty of cases of politicians, generals, people high ranking in the Israeli state talk about how mass starvation can serve important war goals, talking about transfers, eventual goal. You know, Netanyahu compared Hamas to Amalek, you know, who Israelites are biblically commanded to wipe out, not just the soldiers, but the women, the children, and the suckling babes, you know. So, I mean, there's 12 pages of this stuff in South Africa's original filing at the ICJ. So it seems like whatever other claim you want to make, right? Like I think lack of stated intention, never mind intention that you can infer from actions, which is actually usually how genocide prosecutions work. But the amount of stated genocidal incitement has actually been off the charts the last 5 months.
Yeah, so much so that the only responses that you see are what Destiny sometimes does, which is to take one or two of those quotes and look and go, oh, there was some context right after he said this. He said, oh, but of course we care about civilians, or saying, well, you know, those people don't have very. I just got an argument today where there's someone goes, so that guy's not really an advisor to the defense minister. And, you know, you look it up and it's like he's there going, I am an advisor to the defense minister. All right. So So
and we also get this amazing game that like was being played starting in October, where every time one of these statements would come out, it'd be like, well, look, I mean, sure, that's an elected official who's a member of the ruling party, but it's not, you know, they're not. Okay, sure, that one's a member of the cabinet, but they're not a particularly important member of the cabinet. Okay, that one's the defense minister, but he's still not the final. Okay, that's the prime minister, but, you know, maybe he had something else in mind when he said it. And who knows?
What I always notice real quick about those kinds of rejoinders is they always rely on an interpretation that would maybe be true like 0.5% of the time, like 1% of the time. They're like, you know, there's this one little way in which that could potentially be, you know, not true. But then it's like hundreds of those. Do you know what I mean? So the odds of like it just starts to get so unrealistic. It's like finding these like ridiculous.
And I'll also say that something that, like, just before we watch a little bit more of the debate, just a bigger picture thing that really bothered me while I was watching this is that, you know, normally my frustration with Stephen is that I'll often see him get stuck on points that don't really seem to merit getting stuck on, right? You know, I'll see him do debates where he thinks he's kind of got somebody on something and he'll be like super focused on a point that like often risks, you know, losing the forest for the trees. And that's like bad in its own way. Right. That's a sort of more general sense over the years that, you know, it's oftentimes not really the most important thing in dispute. But what bothered me here was a little bit different, although it's related, which is that he tended to like sort of, you know, he would, when it was his turn to talk, he would sort of say four or five things at once. And some of them were like really big, and some of them encoded just these giant assumptions that you'd really want to question. But then there'd be like one little, like, you know, there'd be one like very narrow point in there that if you weren't answering immediately, it's like, hey, Nathan, I want a yes or no response on this.
Stop being evasive.
You know, I mean, sometimes. Like sometimes if you say sometimes reality is ambiguous, and two, like sometimes if you say something that encodes all kinds of assumptions that one might wish to question, right? Like this is, if you're just giving a immediate yes or no response, you know, that's not really productive in terms of finding the truth.
Wait, there was one more thing I just wanted to say on genocide that I think is a very common mistake that people have, which is assuming that genocide is just killing all of the people, the actual individuals, and ignoring the part of it that is trying to destroy a people, that is a society, a culture. And one of the points that's been made about Gaza is that because mosques... because centers of public life, theaters, you know, everything, because it's all lying in ruins. The people, there are people who are alive, but you are destroying their cities, their culture, their history, their memory, their ability to function as a society. And if people end up being dispersed, they might end up, you know, across to many other countries. There might be individual surviving people. There might be plenty of them. But you will have destroyed a society, a people.
Right. Yeah, no, this is definitely, you know, right. And again, in terms of certainly the legal definition of genocide, that is also something that's emphasized in the UN Convention as a form of genocide. But, you know, and it's just, again, it just seems overwhelmingly clear that the example that's like stuck with me the most for the last few months, maybe just because I've spent so much of my life at universities, is that the, you know, a couple months ago, the last remaining university in Gaza, you know, they used to have a few, was blown up by the Israeli military, not even through aerial bombardment, but by a controlled demolition, which is the kind of thing that just over, you know, just very clearly screams to me that the goal is not, oh, we're going to get rid of the Hamas guys and then Palestinian life will resume as before in Gaza, right? It screams, right, we do not want it to be possible for Palestinian life to resume, you know, as what passes for normal in Gaza, right? Which is extremely consistent. If, you know, it's extremely easy to understand if you think the goal is to create conditions which will get, you know, large numbers of people to accept, you know, quote unquote, voluntary resettlement. It's extremely hard to understand if you think the goal is to have these 2 million people continue to live there, you know, going forward.
Right. And understood properly, the destruction of the university is part of the genocide, right? And this is why it's just such a problem to only think of genocide as herding people into gas chambers and systematically executing them.
Yeah.
Let's have questions, but let's get into the debate, actually. It's just like, what do they even fucking say? They say there's tunnels under the universities or something like
that. There have been militants in it.
Yeah, which is like, okay, I mean, maybe, but...
Well, they don't even provide evidence generally for these things.
Exactly. Yeah.
Even if it were true, it's like you need to, like if you're blowing up the university when it doesn't have any militants in it, I mean, that you're not killing them, you're just making it impossible to have a university there. And presumably the thing about people is that people who are once in one building can in the future be in other buildings, right?
That's just like, too much. So, but I mean, it's a controlled demolition, right? So I assume that it wasn't like just
full of people at the time it happened.
Hanging around there waiting to.
I'm sure if you take any major university in the world, there are many examples of, you know, horrible, you know, Harvard, you know, think about all the, think about all the monsters who have at one time or another.
Well, falls at Harvard. Yes, although I'd say there's an argument for blowing up Harvard.
Willing to entertain it as a possible course of action.
This was an atrocity, blowing up Harvard.
It's a threat until they nationalize, right, and become part of the state system of Massachusetts, like Ben likes to argue. But anyway,
this is my article in Jacobin a few years ago Yale was considering changing their name, and my suggestion was that they change it to UConn New Haven after being incorporated into that system. So yes, Harvard could be UMass Cambridge, etc. But all right, so yeah, let's maybe so we're gonna do we're gonna watch like a few different points in it. We're not. For all sorts of reasons.
God, I can't believe I have to listen to this thing again.
I'm so sorry. Let's maybe start around 11 minutes in.
This is painful.
Palestinians as a whole and combine it with the West Bank. The West Bank tends to do better than the Gaza Strip, but the Gaza Strip is not, as is often described, a concentration camp, an open-air prison, being starved.
This is an interesting point. I'd like to dwell on this because... Sure. I did see that
you know, on the on this question, this open air prison. I mean, the term concentration camp obviously is not one that I try not to use. I mean, internment camp maybe is more accurate. The term concentration camp does conjure up images of the Nazi death camps in particular. But one of the things I noticed in the argument that I've heard you make a couple of times is, people say Gaza is this open air prison. However, and you cite the Coleman Hughes blog where he says, look at the development indexes. It's not. It's similar to other countries in the developing world. And I was interested in that because I just didn't think it was relevant to the question of whether or not it's an open air prison. I mean, I've visited prisons that the life expectancy might be the same on the inside as on the outside. The amount of food people get might be the same on the inside as on the outside, but it doesn't affect whether or not it is or is not a prison. That's about conditions of confinement, right? That's about whether people can leave. That's about whether people stay or go. Not really anything to do, if you said of the Japanese who were being interned in the United States, look at their life expectancy. It's the same as Mexico. I think people would find that a very weird argument that they weren't in fact in an open air prison. I mean, it just seems to me to be entirely separate questions. One having to do with, degree of a freedom, degree of control, and the other having to do with the effects, the level, the number of effects, and there are, particular kinds of effects. Obviously, people in Gaza weren't starving to death before. Now they are starving to death or on the brink. We're seeing warnings from every single human rights organization and that the deaths have begun. I don't think it proves that they're not an open-air prison.
So the issue that I have when I do conversations relating to especially Israel-Palestine, but it applies to everything, including domestic issues in the United States, is that when people favor more extreme descriptions of what's actually happening than what's actually happening, what happens is the entire debate, rather than trying to figure out how to alleviate situations on the ground, the entire debate switches over into arguing about the more extreme uses of whatever euphemistic language is being employed. So when we say, for instance, that Gaza is an open-air prison, that is not meant to imply that it's just because movement out of the country is restricted.
Okay.
Because the open-air prison immediately after will follow what you just said about it.
So this is one of the things I was watching this. I was in Michigan last week. I did like a guest lecture in Matt McManus's class and, did a thing for Detroit DSA and whatever. So I had a last night I was on the plane and I was watching this debate to get ready for this conversation. And there are, and this is one of the first lines that really bothered me for a couple of reasons. And I think that a good entry point into all of them is, and I know this is going to sound very nitpicky, but I think this is actually a really important point, that he said, so all you mean when it's a prison or that people aren't allowed to leave the country. And I don't think it's a particularly nitpicky or pedantic point that Gaza is not a country. Like this is actually a really important distinction that, and this is something that I think a lot of Israeli apologist rhetoric talks about Gaza as if it were a country.
By the way, if you want to make a defender of Israel uncomfortable, ask them what country Gaza's in. Right. Because they don't want to say that there's a state of Palestine, but they also don't want to concede that there's an occupation. So I think I had this with Destiny actually at one point in the debate too. Almost, what country do you think the West Bank is in?
Yeah, right, exactly. Which is also really significant because we might not even watch it. I know we've got a limited amount of time tonight, but there's a point in the debate where Destiny says, because he uses the presence of large numbers of Israeli settlers in the West Bank, like he manages to jiu-jitsu this into a pro-Israel talking point, which is, something, right? That they have he says, well, of course, any peace deal that was made now, that it would have to have, you know, Palestinian, you know, it would have to be, you know, it couldn't be a retreat all the way to Israel's internationally recognized pre-1967 borders. There would need to be these big Palestinian territorial concessions and a two-state deal, because after all, it would be so unreasonable to pull out all these settlers. And I think you said something along the lines of, well, you know, they could stay if they were willing to become citizens of the new state. And he said, oh, but, you know, right now in the Palestinian Authority controlled areas, you know, Jewish people aren't allowed to live there, which really struck me as a kind of astonishingly disingenuous way of saying that, right? As if the issue were to just like, you know, Jewish people from other countries just wanted to like live in Palestinian towns on equal terms with other people who live there and just be a part of Palestinian society. And there was something that, you know, and that was the issue, rather than the establishment of these militarized beachheads in which the citizens of the occupying power were illegally transferred to the territory that's being occupied. I mean, glossing that as, pretty anti-Semitic. You don't want Jewish people living in the neighborhood. Like it just, you know, that seemed really unserious to me.
I'd agree with you. Yeah. I think we probably share an interpretation of the quality of a lot of the points that he made. But, you know, Destiny is not a strong debater because his arguments make a lot of sense. He's a strong debater because he's incredibly aggressive and talks very quickly and is very, very confident and says a lot of things. And because he's good at spotting, you know, any kind of weakness, anything he can exploit and aggressively going after it. But if you actually look, you know, and think, you know, what is he saying? What is he really arguing here? You start to break it down. You get things like, he's arguing that it's not apartheid because they base it on citizenship rather than on race, but then they base the citizenship on race, and somehow that's a loophole. That was a big argument that we had. I mean, it just didn't make any sense.
Yeah, no, exactly. I think that, you know, Wynn says, oh, so all you mean when you say that Gaza is like a open air prison is that people aren't allowed to leave the country. Well, look, the country right now would be Israel. You know, in the future, there might be a two state deal under which, you know, there's like a state of Palestine, right? That's its own country. But either way, Gaza would not be a country.
They're not allowed to enter the country.
Yeah, exactly. Right. So you know what Gaza is this 25 miles by 6 or 7 miles strip of land, one of the most densely populated ones on the planet, where people aren't allowed to leave there to travel to other parts of the country, right? They're not allowed to travel certainly from there to other parts of the only country that currently exists there, which is Israel, right? That is something that, like, I think people just need to constantly be reminded of, because so many people seem to have trouble remembering it, that there has in fact been exactly one state from the river to the sea since 1967. It's just not a state with equal rights, which is why people, you know, make the point about apartheid. But in even in a two-state deal, right? Well, then Gaza and the West Bank would be part of the same country. And then if you were lived in Gaza, you'd be able to travel back and forth freely as you liked between Gaza and the West Bank, right? The way
it sounds a little different when, instead of saying, oh, all you mean is that they can't leave the country, that's why it's a prison. It sounds a little different if you say it the way it actually is, which is, oh, all you mean is that they can't leave this little strip of land and that makes it a prison. You go, yeah, being confined to a little strip of land does indeed make it a prison, which is why people call it a prison. Yeah, maybe it's like the prison in the movie Escape from New York, right, where the entire city of New York is turned into a prison and the island of Manhattan is a prison. But that doesn't mean it's not a prison. You can't leave this little strip of land.
Yeah. Yeah, no, exactly, right? Yeah, in the Escape from New York scenario, New York was a prison, right? It was a open-air prison. But like, there's a very clear, uncontroversial sense in which it was a prison that, you know, again, you weren't allowed to leave. If you couldn't leave New York City, then yes, that would be a prison. In particular, if New York City was full of people who had once lived in other parts of the United States, had been driven from those other parts of the United States and weren't allowed to go back. They were confined to just this one area, right? These five boroughs. That was the domain in which they were allowed, right? Then absolutely that would be a prison.
Because let's be honest, if you want a more precise term, okay, what would be another description, okay, for a really big confined area, like an entire neighborhood where you put one group of people? Well, the term that we probably have would be ghetto. They confined to a ghetto. And that term is also pretty accurate. We don't use that term because of its, you know, connotations with the Holocaust. But, you know, any term you use to try and describe confining a particular people to, and it doesn't matter whether it's, you know, 1 mile, 5 miles, if they're confined and besieged and there's a big fence around it, none of the terms you could find for that are good.
Yeah, and a big fence that in this case in particular, that, you know, the Great March of Return in 2018, large numbers of unarmed people were shot to death for not even like, you know, ripping down or climbing, but getting too close to the fence with the intention of, you know, doing one of those things. You know, so that does seem very, very prison-like. And again, it's not a small point, right? Like, this is something that so you interviewed me a little while ago for the Current Affairs podcast about some of the same subjects, and a point that I've made in there, which I've been trying to make more often, is that I'm really disturbed by the way that people throw around the phrase "the Palestinians" in this conversation. Oh, the Palestinians did this, or the Palestinians rejected that. The Palestinians, you know, never miss an opportunity to miss an opportunity. That all of these things are, you know, what you're doing, right? You know, is, you know, you're not even doing what you do if you say, oh, the Israelis did this or that, or the Americans did this or that, which is you're using those phrases as kind of a shorthand way of saying Israel, the nation state, or the United States, the nation state, did this or that. You're referring to an entire ethnic group as if it's a hive mind. And what I suggested is that this is, you know, that this use of the Palestinians, you know, we should sort of, it should set off all the same alarms that I think are set off in reasonable people's minds when they hear the phrase the Jews, right? You know, that's like, oh, the Jews did this or that or the other thing. It's like, really? Did the Jews, you know, all have a big vote, you know, to do that thing? You know, that's, you know, and there is a lot of that in this debate, right? A lot of claims about, you know, the Palestinians. That's like, okay, does the Palestinians mean the PLO? Does it mean Hamas? You know, does it mean every single one of the, you know, several million Palestinians who live in Israel, Palestine, and the several million, you know, who live abroad? So that's something that I think is just worth tracking as we watch a little bit more of this. But I do want to just because I'm trying to highlight the things that are the most important moments here.
Be close.
Do you understand this problem with Palestinian leaders continuing to say, "Oh, but then the guy left office"?
No, see, but this is what's interesting to me is that, you know, I've heard you say, I don't accept, everyone else is really, really biased, you know, but I look at the facts, and that your analysis of the failures is entirely one-sided, right? Your analysis of the failures is the Palestinians walked away, the Palestinians turned to violence, all they do is fight, 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 right? This is a one-sided narrative.
It's true. Right? The inception of the Palestinian movement has been one of violence. The PLO started from guerrilla fighters. The PLO have been all about violence since their inception.
Both parties here are violent parties.
Yes, but only one has been forced to contend with political realities on the ground, and that's Israel. That's why Israel, you can say they're violent, but they formed peace with partners that they thought they never would form peace with.
Zionism is ultimately a movement based on conquest and dispossession.
And Islam isn't? What's a caliphate? What was the Ottoman Empire?
I'm not denying the violence of the Ottoman Empire. Why would we
talk about the intrinsic territorial conquest nature of Zionism when Zionists, Israel, have given back land and territory to other countries, but then ignore it? There's no reason.
This is maybe the most interesting example of random whataboutism I can remember watching in a political debate. That's like, look, I think about Nathan Robinson and the things that he's generally known to believe in and stand for. And I'm pretty sure that he's a devout Muslim who is very emotionally invested in defending the legacy of the Ottoman Empire.
If you try to say the Ottomans were violent around Nate at like a party, he's gonna go ape shit and get so angry and start ranting and kind of like a tanky, but for
the Ottoman Empire.
For the Ottoman. No, and that was you to your point, Nathan, it was like he brings out these points so quickly and then like one is like half good, but that was just really, come on. I mean, that's really silly, right?
And I mean, really, if they really were so violent, how could they make such a great chair?
Yeah, that's about on par with some of with the point that he made. But yeah, what were you saying?
Although I will say one reason that he thinks that sort of thing works is that there is a certain kind of leftist, and it is not the kind that any of us is, that does you can fall into the binary. I need to defend the enemy of my enemy type thing. It's what sort of leads a lot of people to wind up defending the Chinese Communist Party on things they shouldn't defend them on, right? And one of the great things that I, you know, learned early on from Chomsky was you just go, oh no, both of those things are bad. I don't need to defend the Soviet Union. The Soviet Union was also bad.
Yeah, I was after the talk, the Detroit DSA talk the other day, somebody came up to me afterwards and they were, you know, they because they knew I'd written a book about Christopher Hitchens, and you know, they were talking to me about Hitchens and the Iraq War, these arguments he used and stuff. And one of the things I told this person was like, I think you can get a lot of mileage in life out of the insight that more than one thing is allowed to be bad.
Yeah.
Right. You know, that like sometimes several things are bad all at the same time.
Right.
Is there a bit of like a race? Did you feel like it was racist? Because to say that, you know, one Muslim is every Muslim or whatever word you want to use it. Like, I mean, you were talking about a very specific historical example of the very same Zionists. I mean, the very same, you know, there's a very clear lineage in history there of the very same people who are there now coming from people who violently dispossessed the people that were on the land. While he was talking about like just random Muslims, it sounded like it didn't really. Like,
yeah, I mean, and this also came up a lot in the debate because one thing that I noticed he repeated several times was in response to claims about land being taken from Palestinians, by which I think you mostly meant like on a state level, right? Like this is like this state will be formed in this territory, and then it's going to seize this, you know, this territory and all that stuff. He repeatedly said, oh, but like the Arabs like sold early Zionists that land. So like what he's talking about are early, like basically the pre-1930s kind of the early Yishuv, which is what they called the Zionist, you know, settlement before the foundation of the State of Israel, that the sort of land purchases, which one, I think, is just not the same thing you were talking about. But two, it does go to the Ottoman point, because like a lot of times what you're actually talking about there are people who were at best absentee landlords, at worst had no clear connection at all to this, who had these sort of old Ottoman era titles that could be sold. I mean, this is the kind of thing you read like Rashid Khalidi, et cetera. He's always talking about, and that this was then used to like evict Palestinians from the land they were on, and to build these ethnically exclusive, you know, settlements, which seems you know, like I think that there is, I think there is this really significant conflation there, right? And I think I also saw Skellumph, yes, I'll bet Nathan hasn't even condemned the Golden Horde yet, said earlier that this is, you know, that there's also this thing that you see where like the really good one is when people don't even talk about the Palestinians as if this stateless population with no democratic mechanism for expressing its will was all a hive mind, but they talk about the Arabs, right? The Arabs is even better because then everybody who's like in a country where Arabic is the language can be counted as part of a really big hive mind. And I noticed that a lot of Destiny's sentences about the Palestinians, I mean, to be fair to him, he didn't use the phrase the Arabs, but he would say things like, oh, the Palestinians attacked in, you know, 1948 and 1967, and, you know, even putting aside that the who attacked who record often doesn't line up with that. Well, what, there's a Palestinian army that attacked, you know, that Israel was fighting with in 1967? No, come on, it was fighting with like Egypt and Jordan, right? This is, but, you know, this is, you know, it's hive minded on an even higher level because, you know, because you're roping in everybody, you know, in like not just this particular Arabic speaking ethnicity, but, you know, the entire region, you know, that's, you know, that the, that they're all part of like one big thing that can be blamed for anything that thing does.
Yeah.
All right. Let's, yeah, I know Nathan has to go soon. So let's go to I think a pretty important, let's see. So if we go to about 40 minutes in, right? Like so and I know the thing that I'm skipping here, although it is important and it's worth noting that there's a lot of discussion in this video about the right of return, right? This is, you know, this is something that that Destiny is fairly fixated on in this debate, right? That like he sort of takes any time Palestinians or anytime diplomatic representatives of other Arab countries talk about the right of return, he sort of takes this as this kind of obviously absurd rejectionism that, see, people say they want peace, but really they're making this wild utopian demand that Israel isn't never going to, you know, recognize, that Israel shouldn't recognize, I think. I don't think that's being unfair to him, his position, but at the very least, he doesn't think they should have to. And the reason I'm bringing this up is because I just think he's like very wrong about this. But two, I think it actually shows, if you want to speak to this for a minute, that the position you're arguing for in this debate is actually a pretty moderate one, right? So you're not really making the case, you know, whether or not you would like endorse it in some sense, right? But you're not really making the case in this debate for like sweeping anti-Zionism of the sort that I, for example, think there's like an excellent case to be made for, but your point, I think, is very simple and it's very U.S. focused, right?
Yeah.
That they have,
that's true.
Yeah. So like, just because I don't want this to get lost, right? Before we watch any more, do you want to just kind of say like, you know, what is it, the thing that like you're arguing should happen, and like what's the mechanism by which it would happen?
Yeah, I prepared for this debate because I saw that he
you know, I saw a number of people sort of walk into a buzzsaw in debates with him, and I didn't want that to be me. And one of the things that I didn't want to have happen was something I saw happen in a debate he had done previously, where they'd gotten into, as you mentioned, a long discussion about, I think in the one I watched, it was about whether the number of settlements increased between 1996 and 1999. And I thought, this is really not where I want to go. What are the points that I really want to emphasize? And the point that I wanted to emphasize is that there first, you know, obviously since 1967, there has been an illegal occupation. Palestinians don't have the right to self-governance. Right, they are denied the right to self-governance. They can't be citizens in a sovereign. They can't be citizens, full citizens of Israel, but they also don't have a state of their own. That's a situation of plain injustice. You can call it apartheid. You can call it whatever. What needs to happen at the bare minimum is that Palestinians need to have that right of self-governance. Obviously, Israel has made it clear that they will never give Palestinians full civil rights within the state of Israel because it would destroy their demographic majority. It would destroy the character of Israel as a Jewish state, etc. Therefore, you are left only with the option that Palestinians deserve a state of their own. Why don't Palestinians have a state of their own? Well, one reason is that successive Israeli leaders, with the exception of a brief window in 2000 and maybe 2008, have consistently opposed the establishment of a Palestinian state. And also, the United States has been totally unwilling to put serious pressure on Israel to change that position and to agree to the establishment of a Palestinian state in accordance with the basic conditions of justice. And I wanted to emphasize that, you know, the U.S., is the party that, first off, obviously Israel is our leading recipient of military aid, but we also support them diplomatically. We are one of the only countries that opposes the UN resolution passed every year or so that is the peaceful settlement of the Israel-Palestine question that lays out the framework of what the two states would be, where they have to be. Obviously, there had to be some negotiations, but we are the ones who oppose the implementation of, you know, this deal, which has been worked out over and over. It's been worked out at the UN. It's been worked out at the Geneva summit. It's been worked out in the Arab Peace Initiative. We kind of know what it would look like to give Palestinians self-determination, and U.S. leaders have not wanted to put any pressure on Israel to agree to it. And so I wanted to emphasize over and over that we have an immense responsibility in the United States to change that in order to get that basic criterion of justice, that is the granting of the Palestinian right to self-determination, to get that condition fulfilled.
Yeah. And this is something that, you know, I mean, I think this is really like worth emphasizing how moderate this is, because the sort of thing that, you know, I mean, I think that that Zionism is just, you know, fundamentally you know, wrong. I don't think there should be ethnostates of any kind, right? This you know, it doesn't matter to me what the ethnicity is. I don't think there should be states that are just for a given ethnic group. And, you know, and really what I would want, right, if don't get me wrong, I'm under no illusion that this could happen just from like diplomatic pressure. I mean, what I'm describing is like a, you know, revolution. But, you know, if it could somehow happen, right, what I'd really want is just for there to be a single, you know, democratic state with equal rights for everybody, and right, you know, and anybody who'd been displaced from the country in the past, you know, or you know, their, you know, children or grandchildren, you know, they can come back and live there. But all you were doing in this debate is just arguing. It's like, look, let's assume that that's off the table. So let's just talk about the thing that is the official stated diplomatic position of like almost everybody, almost everywhere,
including the United States officially, right?
Yes.
Like, this is what Joe Biden says he wants. This is what Thomas Friedman says he wants. They say they believe in the two-state settlement.
Yeah. And so I think the core of your point is just, hey, if you actually wanted that, you would, the United States, you know, which is currently arming and funding Israel's military as it, you know, besieges and, you know, and mass murders and further displaces Palestinians, and, you know, would stop doing that, right? I mean, at the very goddamn least, threaten to stop doing that as a form of leverage, right? And you know, stop, you know, the U.S. would stop providing Israel with diplomatic cover at the UN Security Council, etc. And, you know, and it would make a concerted effort, you know, because if there's one thing, and sometimes people will say, oh, even if all this happened, you know, Israel would just stick to its guns. Maybe, right? Although, you know, it's right now it's kind of unknowable, but, you know, maybe. But I think your point is, look, if you want there to be any chance of the thing that everybody says they want, like not Netanyahu, right? He's pretty clear that he doesn't. But everybody else say they want, right? All of the other countries in the region say they want. The UN has said should happen a zillion times. Even as you say, Joe Biden and Thomas Friedman say that they want it. Well, if you want that thing to actually happen, and you know, clearly Israel isn't just going to decide to grant it, because given the power relations on the ground, it's really hard to see how that would happen. So if you want to change Israel's calculus to the point where they might grant it, then you'd want the U.S. To apply every level of pressure at its disposal, because that's the one thing that might do it. And that's something that, that's something that Destiny was very resistant to, although it was very unclear to me why. He kept saying things like, oh, what, you think the U.S. is responsible for everything our allies do? It's like, well, if the U.S. is providing the guns and the money and is constantly vetoing security resolutions condemning it, then, yeah, it does actually seem like the U.S. is pretty responsible for that. But the other thing that I found really confusing about his position that I think comes out, if we have time to watch one more clip, is that he sort of seems to want to have it both ways, right? Because like you're saying, hey, I think if the U.S. exerted all this pressure, then Israel, you know, could go back to the table and you know, and they would actually at that point, you know, maybe seal the deal on what they almost did. And in the past, you know, Taba, et cetera, right? Which is a two-state deal that at least maybe there's some land swaps, but it was at least roughly based on the 67 borders. And you'd probably have some sort of negotiated compromise on right of return where, you know, Israel at least like officially acknowledged the existence of this massive injustice and at least let in like a symbolic number of refugees to do that. And Destiny's position seems to be, no. Never going to happen. Actually, that, you know, a deal like that, like, I mean, one, he just never seemed to acknowledge, unless I missed it, that, you know, that some sort of like negotiated compromise on that last issue would even be possible, right? But he just seems to think like, yeah, any even token acknowledgement of that is off the table. And actually at this point, because there have been so many settlements built in the last few decades, it would have to be a much, much, you know, like you couldn't even have like anything that was roughly based on the 67 borders. And all I could think is, man, it really sounds like Destiny is making a case for a one state solution.
Yeah.
Like, cause if he's right about this, right, that you can't have like a two state solution based on the 67 borders, et cetera. It's like, well, look, one thing I hope we could agree that it's not okay to do, and this is like the sort of core point of principle that I think you rightly highlighted earlier, the one thing you can't do acceptably is rule over people without giving them rights that without giving them the vote.
Yes, we would think there would be agreement on that, but he did seem to suggest, and I'm not quite clear on his position, so I don't want to misstate it, but he did seem to suggest when we were discussing the apartheid portion that, I mean, he seemed to be giving a lot of justifications for denying Palestinians their basic rights, right? So he would say, well, they're not citizens of Israel, even though they live within Israeli-occupied territory. And I'd say, well, okay, well, then they should be citizens. And then he would sort of move to, okay, but Israel has legitimate security concerns that essentially trump the basic right to have to basic equal rights.
Yeah, which is also amazing who gets to have legitimate security concerns and who doesn't, right? Like if you're a, if you live in Gaza, you know, the apartment block in which you lived was destroyed and
yeah, I got some fucking security concerns.
I mean, your personal security clearly counts for Bupkis in this calculation, right? Like it's very, you know, it's very confusing, right? This is like the right to defend you, you know, Israel's right to defend itself, which I hear about all the time. And have as long as I can remember having these arguments that Israel has a right to defend itself. Israel has a right to defend itself. Okay, at some point, do some of its victims have a right to defend themselves? Like if you're a you know, if you're a Palestinian in Gaza and like your entire family was murdered in airstrikes, like what sort of right to defend yourself do you have, and what would it entail? And it just.
Do you have the right to blow up an Israeli tank if it's about to blow up your apartment building? Right? Yeah. I think these are very uncomfortable questions for those who argue that Israel has a right to defend itself. Right? If they're about to flatten your house, are you allowed to get? Do you have a right to kill Israeli soldiers? They're about to flatten your house!
Yeah, fair enough. Okay, I think so I know we did have time constraints and I have been keeping you for a while. So yeah. We will probably cut off there and not watch what we're going to watch. But I do just want to say, because I saw Yuma1 in the chat asked, just out of curiosity, is there a plan for you to debate Destiny directly on this or is it unlikely for various reasons? Look, I have debated the man on other issues in the past, twice that I can remember. And I'm certainly willing to do so again. I have to say that watching this debate to prepare for this episode, I was really struck by, the reminder of why I like the kinds of debates where there are time limits and it's very clear.
Moderators.
There's a moderator and all that stuff. I think that there's a lot of stuff that went on in here that I think tends to go on in the absence of those things. And so I would rather, you know, do it with those things. Right. So, you know, but look, you know, if Stephen watches this on a stream, which is the sort of thing that he does, and get to this point, yeah, I'd like a moderator. I'd like a pre-agreed time limit. So it's not just
that we're interrupting. I should have asked for those things.
We're not just interrupting each other for, you know, 2 or 3 hours until it runs out of steam. But
I wish I'd asked for those things.
with all that in place, absolutely. Yes. I am very, very happy to chat with him about these issues. I think it would be interesting. By the way, this has been bothering me for the last few minutes. Does he have a rifle on the wall behind him? What's going on with that?
I believe he does. And it also looks like he has what I like to call Hulk sexual lighting, the purple and green lights. I don't know. That's probably not a thing. I just made it up. But to go with my bisexual lighting behind me.
Yeah. Okay.
I got current affairs on the wall behind me. You know, because I'm a sane person. I'm not implicitly menacing people with a rifle all the time.
Yeah, no, it's just very, very odd. And for some reason, I didn't really register it when I was watching it before. I was like, it's just whatever. It doesn't matter. I'm just fascinated by that decor choice. But in any case, yeah, I will. Right. I would like it to, yeah, I'd like there to be a time limit. I'd like there to be a moderator, and I would like no firearms to be involved. But if all of those conditions could be met, I am very happy to do that. Meanwhile, this was really interesting, and I really admire the patience and fortitude shown in it.
Well, so, I learned from the best, because you know we talked a couple days before the thing, and I was studying your technique, because you're known as one of the only people who's done well in a debate with this man. And I realized that one of your techniques, you know, you're calm and you're patient and you stick to the points. So I was admiring the Burgess method and endeavored to deploy it.
All right. Appreciate that. Thank you, Nathan.
All right. I'll see ya.
All right. So we are going to go to the post game a little bit early. We have Jason Miles with us for the post game for GTA patrons. I think we're going to review a little bit of his appearance on the Majority Report from a few days ago. I think there's also going to be an important discussion about the X-Men going on in there somewhere. So, should be fun. If you are already a GTA patron, you should already have the link for the post game. If you are not, there's really no time like the present. Patreon.com/Ben Burgess for $5 a month, monthly cost of a milkshake at a 50s nostalgia diner in 1994. You can get access to the patron exclusive post game every Monday and Thursday night. You can get the Discord server, early access on some things, lots and lots of fringe benefits, but of course, all of those are just ways of saying thank you for helping us to keep this going, and you know, and help all of us, you know, pay the rent in the apartments that you see behind us. So, if you like what we do here, please do consider becoming a patron. If you are already a patron, we will see you in about 3 minutes, something like that. Left is best.